Joseph D. is being interviewed by Renee Garlick for Concord's Oral History Program, sponsored by the Concord Historical Commission. The interview is taking place at his home at 350 Bedford Street on February 14, 1978. Mr. D. is 82 years old. You have lived on Bedford Street all your life. What changes have you seen in this area?
There's been no changes along the street here. I knew all these houses, they were here when I was born and grew up there. And right across the street, there was a Mr. Enid Garfield. He was an old farmer, and he and his wife lived there for years. And when they died, her daughter, Mrs. Abby Saunders, continued to live there and, for some few years until later on she sold this farm and bought one up in Maynard. The next house is belonged to Mr. William Foss, who lived there for years. And later on, he built a house farther over on Bedford Street.
These were asparagus farmers?
Yes. And next house was bachelor Mike Dunham. He lived there alone, a bachelor for years, and he was a farmer. He owned a lot of land up back there. And the next house was a Mr. Patrick Mansfield. He was a stonemason, and later on, his son was in OLI company here. He went over here. He was in the same office as myself. Legion Post was named after him. When we got back, and the Legion was organized here in 1919. And then...
So this was, you would say, the heart of Concord's asparagus country?
This was, there was my Uncle John. He owned a piece of land. Mr. Charlie Prescott owned a big piece here, and just beyond that, and my Uncle John, he owned a strip there, and among all these farmers, they produced a big majority of the asparagus that was raised in Concord at the time, and it was trucked in, it was taken in by horse and wagon, because there was no such thing as a truck in those days. And it was a big industry here, and it was a very thriving, flourishing industry. They had to work hard, but they were well rewarded for it. And then over on Old Bedford Road, they were all farmers. There was Mr. George Clark at Lexington Road, and Mr. Thomas Burke on Old Bedford Road, and Mr. Peter Dalton, and across the street from him was Mr. Frank Peterson. And the McGurns, they were all farmers down Old Bedford Road there, and they were highly successful farmers. They did well for themselves. They all lived there a long way, and time went on, and they passed on there.
Were young boys used to cut asparagus?
Oh, boy. We were taught, and we started to cut early, and they were looking for help, and we were available, so we cut early and had to cut it and pick it up. Tough in the back, but I mean, if you're young in those days, you know, it didn't make it very different. I couldn't do it now.
Is that an asparagus cultivator outside your house?
That was a cultivator, and back in those days, the horses were the thing. There was no such thing as a tractor, and many of my life walked up and down there, but behind that cultivator, I wasn't much higher than the handles, but my grandfather introduced me to it right up there, and that's where I got my start. But everywhere, it was all the same. The farmers, they all had two horses, some of them had four. But all during the outdoor season, they spent all their time cultivating, you know, just keeping the weeds down and everything else there. And cultivating was just as essential as your air you were breathing back in those days. And as I say, the horses were... They had the horses for some 2 years, and and they didn't need any reins. They'd get up at the end of the row, and that horse would swing right around, get in the next row, and go back. He'd go back and forth all day. Never a rein on him. The horse knew as much as the driver.
The horse knew what to do.
He sure did. He'd swing at the end of the row without a rein laid on him. He'd swing around, get in the next row, and he'd keep that up all day.
So now your cultivator has become an ornamentation in front of your house.
It's a relic of the days that are long past.
And your father lived here, and your grandfather?
Yes, my grandfather bought this house here. He came over here from Ireland during the Civil War, 1864, I think it was. Back in those days, the government, the federal government, had what corresponds to a draft in the past wars. You were drafted, but if you could get somebody to replace you, you were exempt then. So back in those days, I mean, the Irish immigration was just beginning to come over in big numbers, and a lot of these fellows that were drafted, they'd be down the dock here in Boston waiting for these fellows. If they could get a fellow to serve for him, why, that was legal, they were exempt. Mm-hmm. And if I get somebody to replace me, that was all right. And a lot of these young fellows, we used to call them greenhorns, and that was a standard name for of any nationality coming over this country. He was a greenhorn. That where he came from, my grandfather, he got his chance, but anyway, he just didn't accept them. He got off the boat in Boston, he walked out here to Lincoln. Walked out.
Amazing.
And he saw down what used to be the Rogers farm, I don't know who owns it now. And he saw a man up in the field with a pair of horses plowing, and he climbed over the wall and went out and asked if he was could use some help, and it just happened it was the spring of the year, so he took him on. My grandfather worked for him for a couple of years, and he bought this house here. It was standing at the time, which is 1864. The house was here then. How much longer for it, I don't know. But he died when I figured out it was 1921, I think it was. And my father took the house over from my grandfolks, and later on I bought it from my father, and they lived here ever since. And here I am.
Well, members of the D family were very evident in the life of the town.
Well, yes. My grandfather, he was superintendent, they didn't call him. He was a caretaker, I guess that was the word. He took care of the Sleepy Hollow Cemetery up here. It wasn't as big then as it is now, but he had two or three men there with him, and he was there for a good many until he died. He died. He was 82 years old, and he died. Then his older son, my Uncle John, he lived over the road here. He had a piece of asparagus on the side. He was a probation officer up in the court up here, which was, at the time, it was on the second floor of the insurance building facing up in the square. So it was on the second floor, when the insurance business gradually grew, they needed the second floor, so the court moved over to the second floor of the town hall, and they were there for some few years until the town gradually expanded, and they needed space, and that's when the new courthouse was built down on Walter Street there today, that brick building there on the left there.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's my Uncle John. And another uncle was Major. He was Michael J. He was when he died, he was the superintendent of the Massachusetts Reformatory up here. He died in 1946, same year my father died. The two of them died the same year. And another uncle, Bill, he was a mail carrier in Concord here for years. He lived up the street here, and he worked until he was 70, and he died. He lived a long life too. He was in the 80s when he died.
I just saw a picture of him yesterday in the very early pictures of the post office.
Yes, the post office was right around the corner from Richardson's there. Store, I couldn't tell you who was there now. That was the post office. Mr. Fred A. Tower was the postmaster for years there.
And your father went into the funeral business?
Yeah, my father worked first for Mr. Willard T. Farrell, who was the, well, back in those days they called them undertakers, they call them funeral directors now. He worked for him, and the town was small, and Mr. Farrell, he used to do some, he used to call them janitors in, they call them maintenance men now. He used to take care of the courthouse over there, and then he used to take care of the bank downtown where the Harbor Trust is now. Back all my days, the middle section institution was saved, was on the left side. You go in the Harbor Trust now, it's all one building, but yeah. Back in my day, the savings bank was on the left, and the Concord National Bank was on the right half of the building, which now is the Harvard Trust. And then at that time, there was an elderly lady who lived next to the bank, up between there and the old cemetery, named Mrs. Holland. When she died, the Middlesex Bank bought the house and tore it down, and the Middlesex Institution of Savings Bank sits there today where that house used to sit, mm-hmm. way back.
And your brother continued in the funeral business?
Yes, my oldest brother. He was a year ahead of me in school. I graduated in 1913. He was a year ahead of me. After we got out of the service, he went in with my father there in the funeral business, and he was there all his life until he died. And then his son Charlie, stepped in and he carried on. He's carried on today. Mm-hmm. I never was interested in that.
You instead went to the armory.
Mm-hmm. Yes, when I got out of the service, the fellow was worked up the armory. He came to me one day and said he was getting a better job. He was working up the reformatory as an officer up there. He wanted to know if I was interested in this job. Well, I just got out of the service. I didn't know what I was wanting to do, so I said I'd be delighted to take it. Anybody come along and ask me anything, I'd have taken it, because I didn't know just why I was there. I wasn't myself there for quite a while. Like everybody else, you get out of the service and you get home, and my school days were behind. Back in those days, very few went to college. About one out of ten young fellows of my age went to college when they got through high school. Stand when you get through high school, you went to work. Now it's just completely reversed, because when you get through high school today, you don't know anything. You certainly got to go along and get yourself something, but it wasn't like that in those days. So,
but it was a good match. You stayed there how long?
I stayed there. I went to 1921, and I retired in 1966.
Well, 45 years, it's a good match.
Yes.
This is the armory on Everett Street.
On Everett, yes, mm-hmm. yes. That was built in 1915. I went there in 1921, and all those years there was a lot of activity there, and town used it for quite a few occasions, different organizations and whatnot. And it was a busy place. The school used it for gymnasium there for some few years. They still do, I think, now on a limited scale.
Now, when you were inducted into World War I, there was the other armory.
Well, yes, I joined Old Eye Company, which is the name of the Concord Company down in what is now the Veterans Building. I guess they call it the
51
Walden.
Yeah.
It was, it'll never be 51 Walden. To me, it'll always be the old army.
The old army.
I enlisted there on December 16th, 1914, if you want to be exact. That's the day I got my discharge.
Company I meant a lot to you, didn't it?
It sure does, yes. It was here for years, and when I got out of high school, I graduated in 13, and I was working in Boston there up until I was called up in 1917. And company was, or the regiment was called, it was, you know, a company, the old 6th Regiment at the time was completely, you know, when the war, first war, World War came along, all the different outfits, they were all, well, they were all broken up and the 26th Division, the units were made, and we just transferred over. Company I just ceased to be, that's all.
There's a picture of Company I, World War I, in the library.
I got one of those upstairs.
Your World War I experiences resulted in the naming of a street.
I was set up with the city of Nancy, which is comparatively about the size of the city of Boston, but it is pretty well banged up by German artillery fire there, because it wasn't too far from the German border, and the nearer they were to the border, the harder they got hit. But the town was pretty well banged up there, but I can remember they were still running, the streetcars were still running on a limited scale, and the young girls of the motorline, that's one of the first things. And of course, a young girl never saw it around here, you know, streetcars were common thing there, but anyway, there was a big, right outside the railroad station in Nancy, which is big as the South Station here in Boston, there was this big arbory, which is the French word for shelter, and they had all built of concrete. You go down a few steps and they turn off to the right, that's in case a shell went down, it wouldn't go all the way down, that it was built that way, but people used to pile in there at nighttime just to be safe so they'd live for warning. I lived in a French barracks, and there were some French soldiers there, and we lived there. We didn't eat with the French. I was given some money, and I went down, made some arrangements in the local restaurant. There was 8 of us. They were in detached service, and we lived there, and we ate the room down, and I made arrangements with the woman. And the restaurant. I had to go down to the city hall, and she had to go down and vouch because she wouldn't have food or ration over there. Mm-hmm. So I went down and told her what my story was. So she asked me to go down with her down to the city hall. So she was recorded. They were taking in 8 more customers, if you want to call on that. Mm-hmm. But that's the way we lived while we were there. And every 2 or 3 weeks, then one of the company members of a motorcycle there, and we'd give me some American money, and I'd go down to the bank. The banks were still open. I'd send them the French money, and I'd pay them from week to week, as often as I got it. So that's the way we lived up there in the city of Nancy. But it made a tremendous impression on me. So when I got home, and a little later on, they started developing this land, and with a map, and I 2 roads there, and I got right off the bat, and I'd like to call one of them Nancy Road, and there it is over there today, and every time I go by it, I feel quite even proud of it. So.
And this was about 1953 when it was named?
53 or 54, mm-hmm. Thereabouts.
Yeah. So that gave you your first real look of what war was like.
Well, it was just a reminder to me, you know, a pleasant one from
how good the people were to you.
Yes, they were. When I was going to school, you had to take one foreign language. There was English, French and German. Well, you had to take one or the other. That was so, eating me, knee, my knee, oh, I took French. Anyway, I could have been the other way around, but anyway, I like French. It just came easy to me, and then God, 3 years later, I got over to France, and God, to my amazement, I found I had a pretty solid start on French. So after I was there 6 months, I could speak with the French people just like you and I are now.
Beautiful.
And it was quite a help to me,
You were working at the armory. During the 1925 celebration.
Oh yeah, yes, that was cold as the other winter, the 19th of April, 1925 parade. The car was frigid. not a tremendous snowstorm, cold, they had the freight all booked up, and they carried it out there, but it was tough. They waited 25 years for it, and my God, I couldn't have got a worse day. Snow on the ground. And
was the armory headquarters?
Yes. The armory, well, for a good many years. That's why I didn't participate in many. I did a few here and there. 19th of April parades, because the Army was parade headquarters, a lot of activity, and I had to be on duty there, so I did a few of them whenever I could, but then, of course, my color bearing days had a Memorial Day.
Mm-hmm. You lived through the transition era from the horse-drawn wagons to the automobiles? Mm-hmm.
I sure did. There was no such thing as a automobile. And back in my days, when I was a kid, the street cars used to come over here, and that was a big event. You could ride from here to Lexington or Nickelback in those days, or some such thing. But it opened up things. You get from a horse and a wagon, you know, when you get an electric car, boy, you can go some places.
So the streetcar tracks ran along Bedford Street.
Yes, they ran along mm-hmm. the further side of the street there. And there was another streetcar line, Compton, Maynard and Hudson, they called it. That came down from, naturally, Maynard and Hudson, and they met right downtown, the turn out there, as they called it, in the days. And this line written, and people had transferred from one car, if they were going up to Maynard, but you get on the top of one car and get on the other one. That was a very thriving, flourishing industry there for quite a few, some few years, until Henry Ford showed up, and he kind of revolutionized things, and gradually the streetcar lines faded out, and after a while they just gave up.
The streetcar conductors then were known to the people along the way here?
Oh, boy, there was the modem and the conductor. There was two on the car. You got to know them. They ran on a schedule, like about every hour, 3 o'clock an hour, wherever it was, but they were very friendly, and I guess I guess I told you that, you know, but if you want something downtown, and wait till they come along, and you go out and eat a dime with them. If you want a loaf of bread or a daily newspaper, they'd get it downtown with a short time. They'd be there 10, 15, 20 minutes, whatever it was, and they'd stop on the way back. They'd walk in here, and then they'd give you the whatever you wanted downtown. You'd pay them and have a little chit-chat, a few minutes, and the passengers sitting out there just as calm and contented. Today's rush was entirely missing in those days, and they were nice days. But I was, the conductor, they were almost good to be family friends after a while, because you knew they were coming over the road a certain hour every day, and he'd watch and wait for me. If you didn't ask him to do anything downtown, you'd just give him a wave. And
what a different tempo of life.
Those delightful days. They gradually were replaced by something else, but those are nice, pleasant days.
You've seen the roads change entirely from, you know, the real mud roads.
Just gravel. There was no such thing as a hard top there back in those days. Nothing unusual. You had a horse and a wagon that was stuck in the mud. You know, that's all that was there. I mean, in the spring of the year, after the snow had melted, it had melted. God, there was ruts, we used to call them. You get in the rut there, and boy, you just have to keep going. You couldn't get out of them. But gradually, you know, conditions of the roads were improved, and they got the macadam, what they call it, fairly hard surface, which was a better than mud. But,
and the road department was on Everett Street?
Department of Roads and Bridges, as they called them those days. That is where the Everett Dams are today.
I see.
It was there for years. Mm-hmm. And horses and So I must have had a secret right there, the horses, of course, and all the dump carts and wagons. There was heavy animals to pull, but no such thing as a truck. That industry hadn't come along yet. Everything was horses and wagons.
Do you recall Nick McCone's garage?
Yes. McCone brothers were among the very first of the people in Harvard that were an automobile agency. They were the Plymouth, the Chrysler and Plymouth dealer. They were there for years. The industry grew, same as the automobile industry. They were highly successful there. They sold quite a few cars as the years went on.
They were really pioneers then.
And they were fine fellows, especially, and every one of them was a natural mechanic. They could anything that went wrong, my God, they could fix it. But very, very, very popular. No, they had a lot of good customers in Concord, and they were highly thought of. And Peanut is carried it on now. I guess Joe, his brother, runs the store now. But their father was Nick, who was one of them. If there was one that can't better than the other, I suppose I'd have to give first price to Nick, because he could fix it, no matter how much of a heater it was. Nick could get him running again.
I saw a picture of Judge Prescott Kies in a very early automobile the other day.
He had a Stanley steamer. It was made in Newton. It was, I can see him now. 4104 was his number. He had that for years. He had it all the years he was living. He was a judge in the court. He was an autocratic sort of a guy. Judge Kies there, and boy, he was a powerful influence in this town all the years he lived there.
You've been very evident in the color guards of the parades for many years.
Yes, I started in, and the Legion post was organized to come into being up the Army there in the fall of 1919. September, October, somewhere along in the fall, and the following year, we gave Memorial Day 1920, and we had our colors there, and commander, it was Tom Anstey, lived over the road here, the fellow the post was named after. We would stand there ready to go, and he wondered if I'd carry the flag, I couldn't show anything at all to help, so I took it, and somebody made a record of the roster of the parade down the line. And the following year, they came to me one if I'd do it again. I said yes, and one year followed another, and that was 1920, and I did it for a break up from 1975, which was my last one, 55 years.
Beautiful.
I'm not boasting on this. Thankful to the Creator, He gave me a long life and excellent health, and who could ask for more?
You are also familiar with the farmers of the Virginia Road area.
Well, yes, I started with Mr. Frank Peterson on the corner, old Bedford Road, and then Mr. I think his name was Lawrence, and it was Kenny family, and the Wheeler farm, the Fred Carlson farm, and the Catherine, that was the end of the Concord Lincoln line. And that's in this particular incident, I'll just tell you about what I heard.
You could tell.
Yeah, all right. Well, one of the farmers down there, Mr. Fred Carlson, he had made several attempts to try to get the town to improve the road down Virginia Road, which I think he was justified in it, because Virginia Road was a side road, off a side road, and by the time they got there, there was never much done to it, but anyway, he tried for several years to get the road improved, and he just didn't get the first base of this thing. And the following year, they They had a committee appointed to the advisability of buying the first motor vehicle for the fire department in Concord, which was up until then had been horse-drawn. And the committee turned in this report there, gave a very favorable report on this particular. Turn in these facts and figures and for the town to adopt, and before they took the vote on it, Mr. Fred Carlson got up and after all these glowing reports of what it would do, he got up and he said he'd like to see it go down Virginia Road in the spring, which caused quite a bit of applause there, because what he'd been trying to do for 3 or 4 years, he got the road fixed when he made that remark on the floor of the town meeting. So,
that's how Virginia Road got repaired.
That's how Virginia Road got repaired, and every time I go down by there now, any time I go by to Mr. Fred Carlson's house, the house was set up on a ridge. It's long gone. There was a barn right across the street, and that's gone. And the only trace of it is there's the base. He used to have a couple of greenhouses on the right there, and you can see the concrete, the base of it. That's the only. Any trace of it of the farm, because he was a good farmer, and then he built a greenhouse so he could keep himself busy during the wintertime. Yeah, well, when I was a kid, everybody had wood. There was no such thing as an electric stove or a gas stove. It was unheard of, but everybody burnt wood. The old kitchen stove there, an old heavy stove, threw off great heat. But it wasn't unusual that these fellows came along. We used to call them hobos. There was no disrespect to them, but that was the common word for these fellows that come along, and they'd see the pile of wood up in the backyard, and they'd come up to the door and want to know if they'd say they were hungry, and they wanted to know if they went out and sawed some wood or split some of the wood, if you'd compensate them by giving them a meal and other. Along with everybody else along the street, that they're always considerate to them, they'd go up the pile, and they gave good value. They wouldn't be out there 20 minutes, but they'd spend an hour, they might spend a couple of hours sawing or splitting it. And mother would call the bidder and sit him down, and she'd have a good meal for him, and he relished it, because he said he was hungry, he didn't know when the next wound was going to be, or what it was going to be, or whether it was going to be even. But he'd appreciate the meal, and he'd thank you and be on his way. And that was, used to be quite common, and if they came along next year, which they probably did, they'd know where the soft spots were, and then they'd sort of pile wood up in the yard, or they'd ask if they could saw to split it, and if they'd give them a meal afterwards, they were very grateful. Pick themselves up and move on.
That's something that's no longer.
No, that's right. I guess that thing of the other day, that's why I put it down there, and I don't know whether you'd be interested in it or not. But
well, thank you.